Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. For 100 years now, Americans have found themselves in our national parks. Our Think producers asked visitors to the nation's capital if they had a favorite one or one they really wanted to visit.
Shenandoah. It's brilliant, especially the fall.
Central Park? Is that a national park?
Ooh, that's a hard one. I really liked Yosemite. It's just gorgeous.
Grand Canyon. Yeah, but I wanted to visit a big old ditch.
So Acadia would probably be my favorite because it's the one I've been to the most frequently because I love Maine.
Favorite national park? Oh, God, I've never been to a national park. That's kind of sad.
Oh, I really want to go to Yosemite really badly. But my favorite right now is Rocky Mountain National Park. Oh, it's beautiful.
The first national park was established at Yellowstone in 1872, but the Park Service itself was not created until August of 1916. A century later, the Park Service employs more than 22,000 paid workers and 10 times that many volunteers, with a $3 billion budget and more than 84 million acres under its stewardship. It also has modern-day challenges: the wear and tear of 300 million-plus annual visitors, concerns about the underrepresentation of people of color among park rangers as well as visitors, the effects of climate change, and even big questions about whether parks should be wired for digital coverage or remain refuges from constant connectivity. Jonathan Jarvis is director of the National Park Service, and he joins us now to talk about the evolution of his agency and its mission. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
What role do you think the parks have played in defining American identity?
Well, I think the concept of national parks is, as Wallace Stegner said, it's America's best idea. It was a truly American idea that we would set aside the very best of the landscape and then later the best of our history for the enjoyment and the benefit of the current population as well as future generations. And to a certain degree, it was our answer to the cathedrals of Europe. As this country became populated, we set aside these places and said we want the public to experience them, not just the royal or the rich.
What was your first job with the Park Service in 1976?
So I started in the nation's bicentennial, 1976, here in Washington, D.C., at the Bicentennial Information Center, and we were welcoming millions of visitors coming to D.C. to learn about their country.
And did you realize at that moment this was a calling for you, or did it take a while?
Well, I think coming out of college with a degree in biology, I went to College of William & Mary here in Virginia. I knew I wanted to work in the outdoors. I wanted to work in public service, and the Park Service is kind of a calling. I had visited some of the great parks of the West right out of college, and so got a job seasonally, and that haven't looked back.
I know that not every national park takes one outdoors, but what is your personal philosophy about why it's so good for people to be out in nature?
Well, actually, there's beginning to be built a body of research that, they, believe it or not, the outdoors is actually good for you, for your health, for your mental health. There's even a body of science around the concept of awe, that we, to stand on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, is something that sort of unites us all, maybe settles us a bit as a human being. I think that being in nature can be great for a variety of ailments, obesity, heart disease, depression, and that's actually a worldwide movement. And believe it or not, we actually have doctors prescribing parks now. It's the Park Prescriptions Program, and there's 40 or 50 pilot projects across the nation.
How has the Park Service evolved in terms of its responsibilities since President Wilson established it in 1916?
Pretty significantly. It started out with just sort of large parks in the West. As you mentioned, Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, Mount Rainier, and a few others in the early days. It grew fairly rapidly, but still in that sort of same vein of large natural areas. In a very famous story, when FDR was coming back, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from a trip out to Shenandoah, then director of the Park Service, Horace Albright, convinced him to transfer all of the battlefields in the United States. At the time, they were managed by the Department of Defense, so Civil War, Revolutionary War battlefields. And it really started the Park Service down the path of telling both the cultural, historical side of our nation as well as the natural side. And since that time, the Park Service has now grown to 411 units of the system, and we represent everything from civil rights sites such as Tuskegee Airmen or the Selma to Montgomery Trail or Dr. Martin Luther King's church and home in Atlanta to the internment camps for Japanese Americans during World War II, to great iconic symbols like the Statue of Liberty or the Gateway to the West, the Arch in St. Louis, to very large areas in Alaska. I was the superintendent of Wrangell St. Elias. It's 13 million acres, same size as Switzerland.
Are most rangers pretty mobile over the course of their careers?
Well, our roots are the military. The Buffalo Soldiers were the first managers of the national park system, and so it's radio. You can't see my uniform, but it has a lot of military roots. And so the organization is that you sort of have to move in order to move up. And so I've moved my family 9 times in my career across a large geographic area. So it is part of the culture.
For parks that shelter endangered wildlife, what's the right balance between keeping that wildlife safe and protected and letting people in to see it?
Well, it's our so-called dual mandate, to preserve these places unimpaired for future generations while at the same time allowing the public to enjoy them. I think it's a great mandate because if you just protected the wildlife and you didn't let the public to experience it, I think our support would wane over time. And so giving the public an opportunity to go to Yellowstone National Park and see bison free-ranging or wolves in the Lamar Valley, to see condors flying over the Grand Canyon, that's a once-in-a-lifetime experience for the public. And frankly, if managed well, the public are, you know, get a little bit of education before they go in, the experience can be beneficial to both.
Does the engagement of the Park Service in conservation extend beyond the boundaries of parks themselves?
We don't have any authority beyond the boundaries, but we look at our parks as sort of the anchor store of a larger ecosystem, for lack of a better term, sort of the core of that. So if you look at Yellowstone as the center of the Yellowstone ecosystem, obviously species are migrating in and out like bison or elk or grizzly bears. And so we hope to have, through partnerships and working with states and other land managers, to have some influence over that, and particularly for migratory corridors. So one of the great iconic species of the West are the pronghorn antelope. And they have a seasonal migration sort of in and out of the Tetons out into Wyoming. And we want to make sure that that route is safe for them. There are no barriers. So working with landowners, say cattlemen, to make sure the fence is designed in such a way that pronghorn can pass through it. Or if there's a major highway, creating a over or underpass for wildlife. So I really think that the core of conservation in the future, in our second century, is all going to be about sort of landscape-level connectivity. And the Park Service can play a significant role in assisting that.
How much evidence do you see in parks around the country of climate change?
We see pretty significant evidence of climate change in a number of parks. Glacier National Park up in Montana is kind of the poster child. We predict within 20, 25 years there will be no glaciers in Glacier National Park, and that will have significant downstream effects to wildlife fisheries. We're seeing fires burn now at least a month longer, the fire season beginning earlier, ending later, and fires burning much more intensely, stand replacing, and new species coming in. And we're also seeing species migrate, arriving in parks that we had not seen before as well. So there are a number of very significant impacts happening from climate change in the national parks already.
So what is the Park Service's approach to mitigating detrimental changes?
Well, we are approaching climate change sort of four buckets. The Park Service has a strong role in public education. We have rangers that can talk about complicated issues, and one of those is climate change. So helping the public understand what is happening. The second is science. We are laboratories. We're the canary in the coal mine concept, so getting scientists to sort of monitor what's going on. The national parks are probably the best last place we have where systems are relatively natural, not other stressors in place, so we can really understand how other parts of the ecosystem are being stressed even more by other things. So we need to have good science. Mitigation is, in a way, our own carbon footprint. So the Park Service can be an exemplar in terms of sustainability and water conservation, use of renewables, all of that. And last but not least is adaptation. And adaptation means that we need to be thinking about multiple futures. So with sea level rise and storm surge, we need to be thinking on our coastal parks where not only are physical facilities, public facilities, going to be sustainable, but also what's the next sort of estuary? What's the next seagrass bed? What's the next beach as the sea moves? And so beginning to plan for sort of multiple futures is key to addressing climate change.
Because climate change has been so politicized in this country, there are people who would say that talking about it is advocacy. It sounds like you look at this as an education, science education perspective as opposed to advocacy.
Well, I don't view any of our work as advocacy. We base all of our public information on good science. And the scientific community is, you know, solidly behind the science of climate change. And our job is to not point fingers at a cause or blame anybody. It's just to talk about it in an open way.
I think about the maintenance of all of those acres of land and even places that have, you know, pretty minor facilities. Can you talk – people maybe understand that you have to go in and fix up the trails and take care of buildings. Can you talk about some of the maintenance functions that the park performs that may not be apparent to people who visit?
Well, our particularly our big parks, but first of all, the Park Service has a lot of stuff. we have a lot of roads, a lot of bridges, a lot of tunnels, a very large sort of transportation infrastructure. That's how people get in, parking lots. They move around in our national parks. And those roads are not maintained by the states. They're maintained by the National Park Service. And then we have a lot of structures. Visitor centers, historic homes, historic buildings, presidential homes. You know, you have a building like the Independence Hall, and it's an old building. It requires a lot of maintenance. And then to support the infrastructure or the visitation, you have water systems, wastewater systems, you know, fire departments. I mean, running a large national park like Yosemite and or Yellowstone is like a small city. And I have all of the components of a normal city. I like to say it's like running a city, except the population turns over every couple of days. So our maintenance backlog is a huge problem. Our backlog is currently estimated about $12 billion. About half of that backlog are roads and bridges, our transportation assets. And the other half are the physical assets like buildings and utility systems. And we've been inadequately funded to take care of that.
We're speaking this hour with Jonathan Jarvis, director of the National Park Service. If you would like to join our conversation about 100 years of national parks in America, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can follow along on social media at the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We thought it would be nice to give you a sense of what the National Park Service does right here in our nation's capital. So last week, we took our microphones over to the Washington Monument. It's right in the middle of the National Mall, which is a national park itself. Park Ranger Mark Reagan showed us around the monument from bottom to top. We started our tour outside. Ranger Reagan, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I have a question about the Washington Monument that I've been wondering about. Why are the stones two different colors?
This was the very first thing, a la the memorials, to be built. It's the only monument we have. Everything else is a memorial. Privately built, it set the precedent for all the subsequent memorials. They're privately built. So when the group's building this, they're generating donations as they're building. As they were building this, though, there was a short-lived political party called the American Party, nicknamed the Know-Nothings. They were a nativist-type group, revered Washington, the monument is honoring. And they didn't like the fact that the main labor force were Irish Catholic immigrants. That just rubbed them raw. And then some of the fundraising effort was you could donate a construction stone engraved to honor George Washington, and they would space those out in the inside walls. Well, they came from what's now all the states of the Union, but also cities, counties, organizations, but also some foreign nations. And one of them came from the Vatican. At the time, about 1854, not all of these had been installed yet. They were being spaced out. So the so-called Pope Stone hadn't been placed yet. And this group decided, no, we can't have, in their words, a papist stone in this revered monument. We can do a better job. So they sort of surreptitiously took over the organization, the Washington Monument Society, and decided, we're going to regulate what stones get in here. Well, they weren't that popular of a group, and so the donations started to dry up. So by 1855, they ran out of money and construction stops. You know, then the Civil War comes 6 years later. That adds into the delay. After the Civil War, then U.S. Grant's elected president. He's sitting in the back porch of the White House staring at what he was calling the big stump. Let's either finish this or take it down, preferably the former. So he gets surviving members of the original organization to visit the White House, brings in members of the Army Corps of Engineers, the official construction arm of the federal government. Hey, we'll jumpstart this with some federal money. The Corps of Engineers will help guide you. They resume construction in 1878. So a 23-year gap. And they go up to that marble quarry near Baltimore, Maryland, and it had played out. So they had to go to a new one nearby. Same kind of marble, but it had a different tone. They tried some other angles, some other locations. Nah, nothing would match. Let's just stick with that. But it was disappointing probably to them because you don't have a uniform shade. Handy for us to talk about that break in construction. And then they resume construction to finish in 1884. And then this is what we're left with.
Can you take us inside?
I don't see there would be a problem with that. Might take a few minutes.
All right, now we're walking into the elevator inside the Washington Monument. It is about 8 feet by 8 feet square. There's a ranger here, and I think he's going to tell us about the monument.
Good afternoon, everybody. How are you guys doing today? Good. So today we're going to the 500-foot level. We have 8 viewing ports around the top, which we guys can see, all Washington, D.C. And today, because the weather's so nice outside, you guys should be able to see out as far as 20 miles. So, the Washington Monument is 555 feet, 5 and 1/8 inches tall, 55 stories. It weighs 81,000 tons and is constructed out of 36,000 stones. The monument is also in the shape of an obelisk, which was used by ancient Egyptians as a sign of immortality. Because when builders wanted to build this monument, they wanted to forever immortalize George Washington. Now that we reach the top, if you guys want a cheap thrill, you guys can look straight down through the crack in the elevator all the way down to the bottom to see where we just came from. Enjoy your view.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now we are at the, not quite at the very top, right? We are 500 feet up?
500.
These are the little windows that we see out up the sides when we look from a distance.
Correct. We're at the base of the pyramidium roof, which goes another 55 feet above us. This is where they cut the windows in, which was not part of the original design. When they had that second phase of construction, they replaced the wooden stairs and landing that the stone workers were using with iron, which is what's still there now. Steam power was now in vogue, so now they could haul the construction blocks up through the middle on a steam-powered lift and then use a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to swing that up and put them in place. So once they got up to this level and they were building the pyramidium roof, when they finished, they realized, well, we got these iron stairs going all the way up, and we got this lift coming up. What are we about putting sides on it and let people either ride that or climb the stairs, then come to the top? We'll cut windows up here. And they did that. That just delayed the opening for another 4 years until 1888. And then you've been able to pretty much come up this way ever since. Now, the elevator went electric in 1902, and so the trip went from 12 minutes to 70 seconds.
Have you ever had to take the stairs?
Oh, innumerable times. I like to do it as a great workout thing because it's 896 steps, so it's a nice cardiovascular workout.
Surely you have a favorite vantage point. You have one of these portals.
My favorite really is looking west, especially in their morning hours because of the sun's angle. You don't get as much of any glinting off of any haze. On a real clear day, you can make out the Blue Ridge Mountains from here. And just knowing what's out there, looking at what looks like a carpeting of trees all the way out in that distance, and then, of course, what's closer as far as the Lincoln Memorial, its reflecting pool, the river, the Robert E. Lee home in Arlington National Cemetery, and what all that has. It's just a fantastic thing to be able to view.
When you get a posting at a new monument or a new park, how do you learn all the things that people are going to ask you?
If you're interested in working in a certain park and they have a vacancy, you probably have already gotten some knowledge about it. And then once you end up being chosen for that park, now you know you're going to have to dive in, do a lot more reading. And it takes a while. There's definitely a learning curve. You get out there, you're going to learn more quickly by talking to coworkers who've been there a while, kind of cut to the chase. But you're always digging in more and more and more. Here, the challenge is that each of our memorials have unrelated stories. So reading about the Korean War to talk about that memorial has little, if anything, to do with the Thomas Jefferson Memorial, which is a whole other host of reading.
You've been doing this 29 years. Is there one other monument, one other park that you would like to be posted to?
I wouldn't mind working at a Civil War battlefield. Matter of fact, I just last night put in for a promotion for Monocacy National Battlefield near Frederick, Maryland, which is kind of a, I won't say little known, but maybe overlooked battle late in the war. But the one beauty about that park, that battlefield, is that you don't have paved non-historic roads and so forth interfering with the historic setting. So now you can actually manage it better and make it look like it did at the time. So to me, that would be a fascinating thing to be involved with. But, yeah, we'll see.
Thanks again to Ranger Mark Reagan for showing us around the Washington Monument last week. We resume our conversation now with Jonathan Jarvis, who is director of the National Park Service. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or follow along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC. John, I'm curious about overlooked parks and monuments. Are there gems in the system that people haven't heard of? They aren't the big name brands, but that you really encourage people to go see?
Absolutely. I think Yellowstone and Yosemite don't need any more promotion. Everybody knows about those. There are hidden gems. I was thinking about this the other day. A couple of my favorites that are lesser known, Guadalupe Mountains National Park in Texas. Everybody knows Big Bend, but few people know about Guadalupe. It's kind of like a little Big Bend right on the Texas-New Mexico border, just south of Carlsbad. Beautiful park, beautiful canyons, big peaks as well. I think in California, Lassen Volcanic National Park, also a lesser known, overshadowed a bit by Yosemite, though Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park gets about a quarter of the visitation of Yosemite and is stunningly beautiful. One of my real favorites out there in California is Point Reyes National Seashore, a gorgeous set of beaches. Here back east, everybody knows Shenandoah, but the Blue Ridge Parkway is just a little south of that, and a stunning, beautiful drive along the Blue Ridge Mountains as well. Assateague Island National Seashore here on the Virginia-Maryland coastline, really exceptional. Cape Hatteras National Seashore, also it's 4.5 hours from D.C., one of the really extraordinary Barrier Island parks that we have as well. Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area, just a couple hours from New York City. The Appalachian Trail passes through it, and beautiful river through the park, and a beautiful place in the fall particularly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
I worked my way through college and beyond as a professional seasonal Park Service interpretation, mostly natural history and some history at Ellis Island. I'm interested in the science in the parks, and as a cognate to another program like NASA, where a lot of science happens and then it benefits the rest of the world as a byproduct, I'm aware of the Canon scholars and a lot of the science research that goes on in national parks. Do you see that kind of science filtering out now, especially with topics like climate change and land management, how animals should run on the ground to preserve or to improve soil versus wearing it down? That's just one example.
Maggie, thank you for serving so many years as a seasonal with us. Yes, there are a number of places that science is underway in our national parks, particularly related to climate change, but species migration, new species. One of the most fun and fascinating opportunities that we have that's actually coming up this summer is what's called the BioBlitz. The BioBlitz is a 24-hour biological survey of national parks. We've done 10 of them. And we do them in partnership with the National Geographic, and we bring in or connect with several hundred specialist scientists, and then we use citizens to go out and identify birds and salamanders and trees and insects and all kinds of things. And it gives us a snapshot, scientifically valid snapshot of that park. This year, we're doing one here in Washington, D.C., in partnership with 100 other parks across the country simultaneously over a 24-hour period. So it's a really exciting program. The Canon Scholars Program, we are currently in discussions about recreating that program, which created about 25 really excellent PhD candidates out of research in national parks.
Some folks are concerned that the visitorship of the parks doesn't reflect America demographically. There are, to put it bluntly, there's an overproportion of white people and an underproportion of people of color. What accounts for that?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, but it is one that we're addressing very seriously. And I think the stats are correct that the visitation of the National Park Service does not, or of all of our public lands, really does not reflect the diversity of the nation. Part of that is economic. Part of it is past experience. I think most of us in my sort of boomer generation were exposed to the national parks through our parents. And You know, this next generation is more urban. Their parents may be working two jobs and don't have access. There's a lack of knowledge. So the centennial of the National Park Service this year is all about reintroducing or introducing for the first time these places that belong to all Americans, to all Americans, and inviting them and welcoming them and saying, this is yours and you need to come experience it and have a great time and learn something not only about the country but perhaps about yourself.
How do you do that? How do you let people who didn't grow up visiting the parks, don't have long family traditions of that, how do you tell them this is for you and you will feel welcome here?
Well, a couple of ways. One is to make sure that we're telling a complete story within particularly the historical side of our parks. So we've been adding new parks over since my administration that are more representative of the diversity of our nation. We added Cesar Chavez National Monument, Harriet Tubman, Colonel Charles Young, the Pullman site in Chicago, which is the Pullman Porters, Fort Monroe, which was the site of the contraband decision, sites that are relevant to African Americans or Latinos. Also, we added Hanauliuli in Hawaii, which is one of the Japanese American internment sites. So we're looking at places that tell a more complete story. That's one is sort of building relevance. The second is the Find Your Park campaign, which is a marketing campaign. Its target market is the millennial generation. We're using celebrity ambassadors, people like Terrence J. and Rosalind Sanchez and Bill Nye the Science Guy and a few others that are have, you know, millions on their Twitter scores and can bring new audiences to the parks.
We're speaking this hour with National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis about the 100th anniversary of the National Park in America. If you would like to be part of our conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, where you can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, talking this hour about 100 years of national parks in America with Director of the National Park Service, Jonathan Jarvis. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or follow along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC. All right, John, let's go back and talk a little bit about these millennials. The thinking goes that they don't want to go anywhere, that their devices don't work. So how wired are national parks, and is there discussion about changing that?
Yes, there is discussion. Let's just say we're not very wired at this point. A lot of our parks are sometimes at the very end of a copper line and outside of a cell tower's capability. So I actually believe that providing some access to technology, some ability to connect, is important to the future. That doesn't mean you're going to have connectivity at the bottom of the Grand Canyon or in the backcountry of Yellowstone. But in the prime visitor areas, in the visitor center, in the hotels, I think having connectivity actually can enhance the experience. It also allows the experience to be shared within a broader social network and on real-time basis. And I think that that's going to be really important to the millennials.
What about people who don't want to be walking on a trail and find some millennials talking on their phones, sharing? How do you sort of convince folks like that to embrace change?
Well, you know, it is one of those sort of age demographic kinds of things. I think that my generation who experienced the parks in a particular way want to say, experience it the way I experienced it. And I think that that's unfair, necessarily. I think the millennials want to perhaps experience it in their own way. I think one of a really good example of that is if you look at most of the photography of national parks in any magazine that you might pick up, you'll notice that there are no people in the pictures. It's always some extraordinarily beautiful, lonely scene. That's very attractive to a particular demographic, and it's actually off-putting to other demographics. Hmm. And we know this through our research.
So who wants nobody and who wants people?
The classic boomer white middle class says, I want to get away from that urban craziness. I want to go to that place. I want to be the only person there. I want to have solitude and quiet. Other particularly ethnic populations look at that as it might be, why would I go there? There's no one there. They're more comfortable in a group setting, and they're more interested in sharing the experience amongst a peer group rather than having it just to themselves. That's not that attractive. So in a way, even our marketing and advertising around these national parks in showing solitude is a turnoff to the community that we're trying to attract. And so we're beginning to change that and to show these scenes with people, and particularly with people that represent the demographic of the nation.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Doug on the line now in Frisco. Hello, Doug.
Hello. My question is, how do you become a park ranger? What are the educational and experience requirements?
Great question, Doug. In most cases, you at least need a college degree. But in what area? It can be anything for that matter, because we have such a wide variety of different kinds of jobs. We have biologists and historians and archaeologists and architects and engineers and public affairs and public administration and MBAs and, across the board. The best way to figure out whether or not you like this type of life is to start as a seasonal with us. And you can actually start pretty young. We have youth corps that work in their high school years. Then once you're 18, we hire about 8,000 summer positions in the National Park Service each summer that work front desk, backcountry, search and rescue, firefighting, all those kinds of things. Or working, giving tours at Independence Hall. And then once you do a couple of years of that, you're actually eligible for application to a permanent position. That's a new authority that was recently granted to us. We're also very interested. Veterans have preference, and it's easier to get in having served in the military. So there are a lot of avenues and a lot of places. And the first place to start, even before getting hired, is to volunteer. We have about 400,000 volunteers that help us every day in the parks, and it's a good way to sort of get introduced to the system.
Are most seasonal rangers students? I've wondered what these folks do the rest of the year, because it always seems very idyllic, but I wonder about how they make ends meet otherwise.
We hire a lot of students, a lot of college students, and we hire a lot of retirees, too, that love coming back, a lot of retired teachers, scientists, and others. So it's kind of a mix. You don't have too many seasonals in that sort of middle core of age because they're all working year-round and can't get the time off.
All right, we'll go back to the phones, 1-800-933-5372. Alexis is calling from McKinney. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, I'm calling because over spring break, my family went on a national parks tour, and we got in for free because of my fourth grader. It's a great program. I think it's called Every Kid in a Park. And I'm wondering what the future of that program is and if I should look again for my other kids in upcoming years. And if you want to put in a plug for the Junior Ranger program, if you haven't had a chance to do that, too.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Alexis. That's fantastic that your fourth grader got you in free. So this is a program we launched a year ago. It is called Every Kid in a Park. It is an opportunity for every fourth grader in the nation to do a little homework online. They download a voucher, and then when they go to a national park or public land, that's what's Fish and Wildlife Service refuges, BLM lands, or U.S. Forest Service, they can turn in that voucher and get a pass, a hard plastic pass that is good for them and their family or guardians for a full year, free access to all of the national parks. It's a great deal. You got to bring your fourth grader, or they have to bring you. And our intent is to do this every year for the next 12 years because we want to have every child in the nation to have an opportunity to go to the parks. Now, we know that some schools don't have the funds for transportation, so we are raising money privately through the National Park Foundation. That's a big initiative come out of the White House to get individual and corporate sponsorships to pay for these field trips to the national park. So it's a great program. And as you mentioned, the Junior Ranger program is an opportunity for kids when they go to an individual park to participate in the Junior Ranger program, complete a series of exercises, learning. They have to take a little quiz when they're done, and then they are sworn in as official Junior Rangers.
With all the scientists on your payroll, surely you didn't pick fourth grade randomly. Is there some reason that that age is the right age?
Fourth grade is the perfect age for really, I like to say, three reasons. One is in most public school systems, fourth graders are still studying or studying their state history, and we manage a lot of really important historical sites. Number two is that in most public school systems, the fourth graders are still under one teacher. They're still in the homeroom. And the third is that a fourth grader in that age will still listen to an adult.
Perhaps the most important, right?
Exactly. You know, fourth graders, they're mobile. They still have that sense of awe. They get really excited. They learn. They're just like little sponges. I've handed out hundreds and hundreds of these EKIP passes to fourth graders. It's just a blast.
What should people know if they want to visit a park, but somebody in their party or they themselves have a physical disability?
The Park Service has embraced providing access throughout our park system for a long time. It's been one of my top priorities. So throughout the visitor centers, you will find opportunities to experience it for those that have visibility impairments. For mobility impairments, we have great access almost throughout the park system to ensure that everyone has a quality experience, whether it's a Civil War battlefield or one of our bigger national parks. So the best thing to do is to go online for that park's website and check out what is available and what is accessible. And even call in is a good idea and talk to somebody on the staff so that we're ensure that we do have, you know, the closed captioning turned on or hearing assistance capabilities so they can experience the parks.
We have an email here from Denise who says, how funny that you would mention the BioBlitz happening in Washington. They've just finished a BioBlitz in my backyard, Tandy Hill Nature Area in East Fort Worth. I'm curious if the results of the survey will be published anywhere.
Denise, absolutely. We publish the results of the BioBlitz. There will be an active live web presence in partnership with the National Geographic Society. In almost every case where we have run National Park BioBlitzes, we have found new species to that park, and in some cases, new species to science. And so all of that gets published because it is a scientifically credible survey of those areas.
We have another email here from Lorna in Mart, which is east of Waco. And you mentioned volunteerism briefly earlier, and the figure I had was 220,000. You said 400,000 annual volunteers. What are these folks doing?
Well, it is over 400,000. We put a big emphasis on increasing our volunteer force. So I'll give you a great example. Just a couple weeks ago, I was in Kennesaw Battlefield, National Military Park in Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. And they were recently recognized with one of our Volunteer of the Year awards for their trail work. And so it's a group of individuals that come in almost every day and they maintain the trail system. That park is very, very popular. It's kind of the central park of Atlanta. It's kind of very, very available, even though it's got a historical context. And this trail crew comes in, totally on volunteers, supervised by our employees, and they do all the trail work in the park. And they do it as a, you know, something to give back, but also they get some outdoor experience at it as well. So volunteers work side by side with rangers in visitor centers. They work in search and rescue, mountaineering, interpretation, IT. We have great numbers of volunteers that are helping us with social media. So people that actually can do that kind of work are of high value to us as well. So almost anything we can set up to help a volunteer.
What's the difference between a national park and a national monument?
One, the national park, the only way you can create a national park is through an act of Congress. Congress must pass a law and signed by the president. That's how you get a national park. A national monument is established under the Antiquities Act, which is an executive power of the president, exclusive of the Congress. So these are two independent ways that both are managed by the National Park Service, they're established in two different ways.
So that explains why there are some national monuments that are essentially wilderness areas.
That's correct. President Jimmy Carter used the Antiquities Act to establish national monuments in Alaska in 1978. And then in 1980, Congress passed the Alaska Lands Act, converting those monuments to national parks.
Are there new national parks like in your sites? Are there places that may be added in the near future?
Well, there's always we're always in the process of studying new areas. Congress has authorized, in order for us to study whether or not a new area should be added to the national park system, we have to be authorized by Congress by an act. And they give us that authority, and then we begin studying it. And there are 40 or so studies underway as we speak about potential new parks. They're all in different. There are none that I'm aware of that are sort of ripe immediately.
The official 100th anniversary is August 25th, 2016. Do you already know what you'll be doing that day?
There are a lot of invitations. I think the one that's sitting at the top of my list is to be at the Roosevelt Arch at Yellowstone.
Jonathan Jarvis is director of the National Park Service, which this year celebrates its 100th anniversary in existence. John, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a real pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and executive producer Jeff Whittington. Our team back in Texas today includes Shelley Canavy and Stephanie Kuo. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can follow along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC. You can contact the show, as always, via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.